Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casinos, the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social.
Michael, why are they taking the balloons down? Who does that benefit?
Well, John, we have these aerostat. We have a line of aerostat balloons on the Mexico border. These are those white helium filled balloons that have sensors hanging off of them. We have these, you know, a lot of these in Iraq and Afghanistan. You would see them everywhere, and they have cameras, of course, thermal cameras and that sort of thing. But more importantly than that, they have. They have sensors for signals intelligence to help us interdict the drug smuggling, which is absolutely massive in destroying, you know, swaths of America. We can all see it on the streets. So Department of Homeland Security, actually a Border Patrol agent sent it to me yesterday, very angry that they've announced that they're going to pull down the aerostats and do other things as well that are facilitating the invasion. As you know, earlier this year when I was down in Darien Gap, I was about to fly up to Arizona to go out with a couple of congressmen, Tom Tiffany from Wisconsin and Biggs from Arizona. I was about to go up there and go on the border with them. And Congressman Tiffany's office told me that Mayorkas is about to fly down to Darien. So I canceled Arizona, and I went to the landing zone that I thought he might land on with helicopters, and I waited for several days, and he did. He landed right in front of me with three Blackhawks, Mayorkas. So Mayorkas flew all the way down to Darien Gap, to Darien Province anyway, and he has doubled the size of the camps. He's doubled. He went into one of the camps right by me, drove like 15 feet away from me. I'd been staking him out for days. And then he went inside one of the camps, San Vicente Camp in Darien Province, and I put the drone up over him, droned as he was down there doing his meeting. And then he got in the helicopters, three Blackhawks, and flew away. And they've increased the flow from South America through Panama. This is very important because as these famines and these other issues, remember, when you get a big famine, you always get pandemic and war. There is no exception to that. I mean, it goes all the way. It's biblical. I mean, it's like you never, if you get a big war or a big pandemic or a big famine, you always get the other two. It's the four horsemen. The fourth horseman is, of course, death, right? And another thing, that there should be five horsemen, because every time you get a big pandemic, famine, or war, which is almost like the same thing when you study them enough, you get huge human osmotic pressure. You get that very significant push and pull of migration. So as we go into these famines, which are they're coming, right, you're going to see huge amounts of Africans and Asians and also South Americans because, for instance, I was just recently over with Jordan Peterson over in Netherlands. I was on a show and then he asked to spend some time with me in Netherlands. So we were together there. I took him out to a farm and introduced him to a scientist and some other people. And one of the people that I introduced Jordan Peterson to is a retired CEO of a big chemical company in Netherlands, who one of their main products was nitrogenous fertilizers using the Haber-Bosch process, right? Where you strip the hydrogen off of the natural gas, you combine it with the nitrogen that's in the air we breathe, and you make ammonia, right? And you can make ammonium sulfate, urea, ammonium nitrate. These are the sorts of things that are used to put an extra estimated 4 billion people on Earth. So you talked about the population on Earth since 1915 when the Haber-Bosch process really kicked off in earnest in Ludwigshafen, Germany. The population has just exploded in large part, not only because of that, but in large part due to these nitrogenous fertilizers. I was at BASF at Ludwigshafen twice this year, warning people. I've been warning on so many interviews that if you see BASF at Ludwigshafen, Germany, close, that is the EU having a heart attack. They're dying, right? And about maybe 9 weeks ago, they announced they're closing down almost all their operations, moving a lot of them over to China. Well, they're not just going to pop up in China anyway. But the bottom line is Europe is not exporting any nitrogenous fertilizers now. This is a huge deal. This means countries like India are not getting their nitrogenous fertilizers. Countries like Brazil are not going to get it. I flew over to Thailand. I know one of the after I spent 4 months rolling around Europe looking at the factories and talking to scientists and that sort of thing, I then flew over to Ireland and was out with the Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou McDonald, very far leftist. She has no idea what's about to come. She just wanted to talk about equity and these sorts of things. And I'm like, Mary Lou, I think you should focus on food and energy, right? Not all this equity nonsense, right? I mean, you're about to have another famine in Ireland, right? Anyway, then I flew over to Thailand and I talked with an old prime minister there. He's a friend of mine, Prime Minister Abhisit, right? And I told him, I said, listen, Thailand is in danger of potential famine. He goes, no, we export, X amount of food. And I'm like, I realize that. I have an office here, right? And I have an office in Chiang Mai. I'm quite cognizant. And I also said that Thailand creates about 8% of the nitrogenous fertilizers it needs. It imports 92%, mostly from Europe, right? And it's not going to get any this year. Zero, right? And you are – the Thai soil is notoriously short on nitrogen because you export so much rice. And rice just sucks the nitrogen right out of the soil. You're exporting all your nitrogen. Without these fertilizers – you could be going into what almost happened in the 60s in Thailand, right? And so the bottom line is many countries that think that they're good to go, like Ireland, they're not calculating all their inputs. They're not calculating that, hey, normally we get all these fertilizers and these other chemicals, the herbicides and the pesticides and the fungicides, which come from the same chemical plants. They're all closed. Of the 29 plants in Europe right now, they're either all closed or almost closed to the point where they don't matter anymore. The ones that create the nitrogenous fertilizer like Yara and BASF. And so, in 1905, when a guy named Fritz Haber, he was a German chemist, he first, in a thermodynamics book that he published in 1905, he described how he thought he could take, the hydrogen off of the natural gas and combine it with nitrogen and make ammonia, right? So about 3 years later, he actually got a little drop to come out, right? And then in 1913, a guy named Karl Bosch, also a German chemist, started to work on doing this on an industrial scale at Ludwigshafen, right? Now, there's a couple of things with this. Of course, the Germans were dependent on using bat guano and bird guano for fertilizer, and other competitors were cutting them out of the market. And out of that ammonia, you can make tremendous amounts of explosives, right? So the Germans started working on the Haber-Bosch. Well, it's called the Haber-Bosch process because Fritz Haber is the one who thought it up and got and created a little bit of ammonia with that process. And then Karl Bosch came along at BASF at Ludwigshafen, Germany, and they industrialized it. So in 1913, they started working on that on an industrial scale. And by 1915, BASF was producing nitrogenous fertilizers and explosives, right? So I went to that plant twice this year. Again, I've been warning, if that plant closes, that's your sign that Europe is, as we know it, dead. And so, when Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 mysteriously blew up, that's like the two arteries in your neck being cut. Now, Nord Stream 2, of course, was not flowing. It was pressurized, but pressure from the United States, of course, Germany was not. When Trump warned Germany about getting their gas from Russia, and they laughed at him, I'm sure you recall that. Those of us who are paying attention to nitrogenous fertilizers and how important they are to life on Earth, to maybe 4 billion people on Earth, we weren't laughing. We're like, so you basically got two arteries that you're going to set up that if those arteries are cut, Ludwigshafen was getting, BASF at Ludwigshafen was getting their gas from Nord Stream 1, right? So those are gone. And so, that's it. As soon as those pipelines were blown up, I was like, Europe's dead. It's going to die, right?
Michael, we're going to go back to the war, but I want to make sure we understand. The balloons that have been used at the border for intelligence gathering and for monitoring are coming down, and there is no immediate replacement. And the presumption is that this is a decision that's been made in Washington. Is that correct, the decision to take the balloons down?
Oh, yeah. It's a DHS, Department of Homeland Security decision, above. Level or higher.
The DHS wants to take the balloons down now because they no longer want to gather data because a political decision again. Who is it that they DHS doesn't want data, doesn't want to have its data? What is the concern?
Us. I mean, they don't. I mean, they're clearly trying to hide. Like, for instance, when people ask, Biden, is he going to go to the border? He doesn't even know where the bathroom is. I mean, but of course, he just blows it off. As do all. Again, Mayorkas landed in Darien Gap earlier this year, right in front of me.
I want to connect. So DHS is moving to stop taking in data that can be used by its adversaries in a political context in Washington. And I presume this means that with the change of leadership in the House of Representatives, what you're expecting, what there is evidence for, is that the Republican House majority is now going to seek that data from DHS. Is that your assumption, Michael?
I mean, they're going to try to get data anywhere they can get it. And, of course, that's going to close a lot of that down. It's also facilitating smuggling of humans and drugs. Children are getting smuggled as we speak every single day. I mean, it's unbelievable, John. I mean, it's the amount that you see down there.
Right.
And I'm sure you've seen some of the videos, but that's 24/7 up and down that border.
And so the decision is made politically here at year's end. No longer to gather data about the flow of refugees, immigrants, migrants from Central America, from the global south into the United States. That decision has been made, is your observation. Is that correct, Michael?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they announced it. A Border Patrol agent sent me the announcement yesterday. I put it on my locals page, actually. So it's up on my locals page as well. So
right.
It's an actual official announcement.
Here we are at year's end. Michael's done a very good job of surveying the scale of this. The migration connected to the war, connected to the what is apparently a breakdown in resources for food and energy. And that breakdown comes from decisions that are being made in various capitals. So I now want to turn away from where Michael is now and go over his last year reporting from some of the capitals that he's mentioned. We're going to eventually get to Vilnius on the Russian frontier. This is Michael Yon. It's michaelyon@locals.com. And your generosity to support his wanderings of the crisis are most appreciated. And when we come back, the Michael Yon in 2021. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. Okay, got that? Now we're going to go to 2021. Got it?
Yep.
1209. Okay, 5, 4, 3, 2, This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague Michael Yon. This is Michael Yon at locals.com to support Michael's reporting. And we leave Michael at the Texas border and get in our time machine and go back to the spring and summer and fall of 2021 when Michael began his investigations of what appears to be a migration of the global south moving to the global north. However, connected to this are the events of the last year that might at first now appear disconnected. I'm talking about war. I'm talking about famine. I'm talking about the severe shortfall in energy in Europe. I'm talking about climate change and COP26 and COP27. I'm especially talking about the leadership of the best armed and most armed nations on earth. That will be China, Russia, the United States, and their allies. So, Michael, let us go back to where we started our conversation, which was your trip to Colombia. And from Colombia, you traveled across the terrain into Panama, and you arrived at the Darien province. This is early in 2021. Darien province is the southernmost province of Panama, and it doesn't connect to Colombia, although at one time it was Colombian territory. There's something called a Darien Gap between the end, the break in the transcontinental highway that travels from the United States to the southern tip of South America. There's a break of about 60 miles. And when Michael arrived, he stayed in a hacienda. The COVID was rampant. In fact, as I recall, Michael, the owner of the hotel you stayed in died of COVID during the time that you were traveling there and traveling back. So recover for the audience now, Michael, who were not with us when you first arrived in Darien. What you saw, this is the spring, summer of 2021. What was your surprise to learn?
Right. You know, I was at the inauguration in D.C. and then flew straight to El Paso because I suspected there'd be a run for the border as soon as Biden was in, and I did, and there was a run on the border. So then from there, flew down to Colombia, suspecting similar from Colombia up through Panama, because when Biden became president, you know, that was a starting gun. And sure enough, I mean, down in Colombia, there were huge numbers of people from Haiti and Cuba and many other countries that were at all over Africa, many from Nepal that were all over. And they were saying, oh, Biden's president now, we can go to America. And so they started their journey through the Darien Gap. Many died. As you know, that's where we encountered Medese. She was 16 years old from Haiti. I was there with Chuck Colton and Japanese journalist Masako Ganaha. And Masako said, I want to talk with that girl. And so she started talking with Medese using translator, and Medese was had just come all the way from Haiti to Suriname, down to Brazil and up to Chile, and finally made it up to Colombia. And that's where we met her and her brother Michael and her mother, and they made it through Darien, and we finally met them up again in Mexico, in southern Mexico. And boy, they told one heck of a story about getting through the Darien Gap and through Nicaragua and so many. It was like a movie. I mean, it was quite terrible. And so then they finally made it up to New Jersey, where they're at now. Right. And you can see Medese just put on her Facebook today about how bad it is in New Jersey, and she wants to go back to Haiti. It's on her Facebook today, actually. So, you know, she's a 17-year-old and not happy in New Jersey, and she has to work a lot, like, you know, all of us. I work 7 days a week, so I don't, you know, I worked when I was 17. I joined the Army when I was 18, so they're not going to get anybody to cry for them to have to work when they get here, you know. But clearly, a lot of the migrants that I speak with, another guy from Haiti, he came up from Brazil. I've been talking with him. He also went to Massachusetts, right. And in Massachusetts, he's homeless, and you know, he has to work hard, but he's still homeless. And finally, he roomed up with another Haitian man in some bedroom that he was renting from a lady, and she didn't want two men living in her home in the same room, so she kicked him out. So he's homeless again. This is the sorts of things that this is normal. These are normal stories.
And from the Darien Gap, because there were many adventures at the Darien Gap. Sometimes I would speak with Michael and we could hear the beautiful birds singing in the background. From the Darien Gap, you started your travels to see other places where the migration was putting pressure on the security. This is the global south moving global north. It's a worldwide phenomenon. It'll go on for the balance of this century. And my memory is that you went from Central America, and you were there several times. I'm not telling the complete story, including flying over the Darien, flying to the place that the immigrants, the refugees, launched through the trackless wonder, very dangerous. 10% of them or more die in that 60 miles. However, you traveled to Europe. My memory is, Michael, you went to Greece. Is that correct? You went to Greece and you witnessed the border security or absence of it along the Turkish border. And they were building a fence at the time. I believe they've continued to build that fence. Is that a correct memory?
That's true. In general terms, that's true. I spent months down in Darien, took a couple congressmen down. You know, Tom Tiffany was one of the congressmen from Wisconsin. Both of the congressmen that I took down won their reelection in a landslide, by the way. I wonder if that's a coincidence. And then from there, you know, it was off in Mexico and that sort of thing. And finally went over to Morocco with Chuck Colton, war correspondent. And then we went to Greece and we went to, where else did we go? To Bulgaria and a few other places. And we finally, went to, that's when we went to Lithuania.
You were witnessing the migrant flow in all of those places, the attempt to get into the European Union in North Africa, the attempt to get into the European Union and NATO through through into Greece, and then the attempt to get into the European Union in Bulgaria and in Lithuania. In other words, you were seeing people trying to cross into governance that provides for them or provides security and jobs for them, they're told. And every time you were there, you saw both resistance and disorganized resistance, is my memory. I believe that there were lots of complaints, but there wasn't one policy in the EU. Is that a correct memory, Michael?
Yeah, there was pressure. For instance, I lived in Poland for 2 years, and I'm kind of familiar with the Polish way. I say they have a non-Newtonian personality. In other words, like in a non-Newtonian material is one, the harder that you push it, the stiffer that it gets. And in Poland is like that. And Germany and others were trying to force Poland to allow these migrants through. And they weren't really migrants. They're weaponized, right? And Poland's like, nope. And the harder you push us, the harder we get. They're not coming through. Lithuania let some through. I went up to Lithuania and spent a month there. And again, I had been with the Lithuanian army in Afghanistan. So they gave me full access because I know quite a few of the officers and that sort of thing. And so they vouched for me. So I'm with the intelligence people and out on the border. They gave me full access to the camps, right? So I got to talk with migrants as much as I wanted. And every one of them that I spoke with, let me say there's one exception to this, that almost everyone that I spoke with were economic migrants. There were some Yazidis that I spoke with from Nineveh province in Iraq. I had been up there for a year as well in that general area of northern Iraq. I spent 2 years in Iraq, all over that place. So when I talk with people from these countries, most of the people I've actually been to their countries, right? And so the Yazidi guy, he spoke German, so we were speaking German together. He didn't speak English. So he said he had lived in Hamburg before. And he was going back to Hamburg because ISIS had rolled in. And so he was an example that I think he probably had an actual claim to get out of there, right? But most of the people are clear economic migrants, like many from Nigeria and whatnot that I was talking with. They were not running from war. They just thought they could go to Germany. Everybody thought they could go to Germany. And the Lithuanians were not going to let them through. And you'll see when I was there, the Lithuanians stopped letting anybody through at all. And so they asked me, because they watched me traveling around the world looking at these border issues. And they asked me for advice. What should they do? Should they let them into the border and bring them into camps? I said, no, stop them at the border. Create as much friction as you can. Keep them in Belarus. Make them build up in Belarus. Put the pressure on Belarus. Because you're not going to stop the flow if you just let them go through. And you can see in the news, it happened at the time when I was there. They just stopped. They weren't letting anybody in. They were keeping the ones in the camps that they already had. Now, I was with one of their members of parliament. We went out to the camps, and he offered them. He said, if you leave now, we will pay for your way to go back to your country. You can choose to stay, but you're going to stay in this camp. You could be in this camp for 6 months or a year, but you're not going to be set free and Lithuania, and we're not going to send you to Germany. And so, to my knowledge, nobody actually returned. Now, there was actually some people there, like Chechens. Ask them about the Chechens. I'm always asking about Chechens, you know. I said, how many Chechens do you have? They said, well, we keep those separate, because once you get over about six Chechens, they called that Chechen critical mass. Once you get over about six Chechens, they become like gangsters, right? So they were keeping the Chechens separate. And the ones that I did meet, they actually spoke German as well. They had been in Germany before as well. And so you had people from all over the world. You had Chechens. You had people from many African countries and Middle East.
Michael, go ahead, sir. A detail, because we didn't know then. I mean, this is the summer of 2021, 6, 7, 8 months before the invasion. At any time, speaking to the well-informed intelligence officers of Lithuania, did they evidence to you that they thought that there were odd things going on in Belarus? Remember, there were military exercises being staged year after year in Belarus. The Russian army would gather together. Was there any talk, you know, the way you soldiers talk late at night about things you've seen, that Russia was building towards a military operation, anything like that in the summer of 21?
Oh, yeah. They're very clear. You know, they don't trust the Russians. They were building you know, their defensive, you know, obviously Lithuania is not going to go on offense against Belarus or Russia. They're too small, right? But they were building, you know, a defensive, a means to defend. And one of the main means of defense is actually a good alliance with Poland and a good alliance with the United States, right? And so that's why actually Lithuania was there in Afghanistan, right? When I was in Afghanistan with the Lithuanians, they were very clear about it. They're like, we don't really, you know, have a good reason to be in Afghanistan, but we have to show the United States that we are here for mutual defense, to uphold our side of the treaty, right? Because with the NATO treaty, because someday we may need the United States, and we want to be able to say we've always gone with you, right? And so this is that time, and it was wise for them to, you know, stick with us in Afghanistan and other places for those reasons. And so now they realize, you know, one of the things that they're trying to build is the sort of a mythology, let's say a national mythology, called the Forrest Brothers. And the Forrest Brothers were a resistance in World War II that they fought against, Nazis and communists, because they had them coming and going both directions, right? And so they were resistance that lived out in the forest, and a lot of them lived in little spider holes. Actually, they took me out to some of the old positions, and they were like, you know, we're working to build our national character as one of resistance. Like, Russia can invade. It's very difficult to stop them. As you can see, it's flat land and it's kind of perfect for invasion. But, you know, we can make it tough on them, right? Maybe we can take out certain bridges. We can, you know, and hopefully we can create enough delay that the United States will, you know, help us out with, you know, things like Javelin missiles and that sort of thing, as you see what's happening in Ukraine now. And by the way, I want to be very clear. I thought that the Ukraine war was bad from inception, and I think it's getting worse. I think this is a huge error not to go into that. That's a whole separate topic. But this is creating more of the human osmotic pressure. It's also interrupting flows of food. It's interrupting flows of fertilizer. It's part, when you look at the global condition of what's going on right now, it's very clear that the famines will start in 2023. And how 2024 is going to look is unknown to me, but this is all I study 7 days a week, traveling around the world, looking at chemical factories and talking with military officers and talking with farmers and that sort of shipping companies. And it's very clear, you're not seeing in the news what I'm seeing from both the ground view of being there literally with soldiers and on borders, and also from the space view when I'm out talking with CEOs of chemical companies and that sort of thing. We're clearly going into global famines, which are going to drive that human osmotic pressure, which is going to open it right up Darien Gap, which is a major highway to the United States.
Detail here, Michael, because you've touched on a lot of hot topics. Your time in Poland, as I recall, you were training with the U.S. Army at the time for the theoretical invasion from Russia across the European plain. And we were cautious to emphasize that this was a moment in time when you trained there in the gap between Belarus and Kaliningrad, the exclave that Russia dominates with, we're told, major weapon systems. Sometimes we're told tactical nuclear weapons, but in any event, your observations about the Ukraine war, I don't want to go too far afield. I want to stay with the migration story. But the Europeans have accepted many of the millions of people who've left Ukraine and have moved into Poland and to other parts of the EU. Is it your measure of that migration that is different than the global south, or is that the same thing, Michael? The war is an aspect of the migration, is an aspect of the war. I just want to know whether this phenomenon is distinct, because I've had reports that the Ukrainian people who have left have been welcomed in the EU. Is that something you've heard, Michael?
They're clearly related, but let me clarify something. I was in the 10th Special Forces Group, and the two A teams that I was on did train to parachute into Poland. I can say that now. Obviously, it was secret at the time. We did not actually train in Poland. We trained in places like Europe, actually. and the United States for cold weather and that sort of thing. And it was quite intense training. When I lived in Poland, that was after the army.
Right. Well, so, of course right, you weren't training in Poland during the Soviet Union. I understand.
Right. That would have been quite a training exercise, but that would have been live fire. So, but that's what we trained to do. That's one of the reasons I'm so familiar with Poland is because we studied it. You wouldn't believe how much your special forces actually study. A lot of it's, you know, out in the field training and doing combat training. And a lot of it's actually, like, I went to language school for German and another one for Polish and that sort of thing. So, I mean, so it was a lot of study. And that actually helped prepare me for, you know, the things that I do now.
Are the Ukrainian refugees, migrants, are they being well received in Poland and other parts of the EU? Have you heard any different?
Yes and no. Now, as you know, the Polish and the Ukrainians kind of get along like Canadians and Americans, right? So they've got a warm relationship. However, it's the, you know, the Polish are being overwhelmed, right? And so, you know, and they're being strained as well. So it's not a matter of we don't like you. It's a matter of, you know, hey, this is getting stressful for the Polish as well. And likewise, and you know, for instance, when I was just over in places like Germany and Netherlands, it's the same, you know, as you know, I just spent 4 months over in Europe, all over the place, Hungary and, you know, all sorts of places. And, so yeah, but nobody has anything against Ukrainians. Right. I mean, generally they get along with them quite well, but they're already stressed, right?
Right. No, I understand that. The information we get, it's all fog of war, is that the Ukrainians plan to return to Ukraine once the war winds down or there's a ceasefire and armistice and not stay on in the EU, which is quite different from the great migration underway from the global south. I wanted to make that distinction. Michael Jahn, and it's wonderful to speak to you again, Michael, and I hope we can continue this conversation because all of the reporting that you did in 21 is now right in front of us for 23, and you've identified fertilizer is one of the vulnerabilities. There are many others, of course, energy, coal, natural gas, oil. All those resources are now at risk, and the supply chain is broken down. We know that the pandemic we've been dealing with for 3 years continues, damaging in China now, and we can presume that there are threats to other parts of the world that weren't hurt in the first and second and third waves. So Michael Jahn, where to follow Michael's reporting is Michael Jahn at locals.com. Locals.com. L-O-C-A-L-S. Locals, as in I'm local. Locals. And .com is where to follow his reporting. And Michael puts up video. He puts up notes. He puts up the information he gathers together. All of it will come together in the future as we now have touched upon some of the themes that Michael ran into in these last years of watching this phenomena for the 21st century, the global south moving to the global north. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.